The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to Bugle issue 126 for the week beginning Monday, the 6th of September. Oh, hang on, I wrote that a week ago. Sorry, we weren't here last week. Unexpected family circumstances got in the way, but we are back this week with me, Andy Zaltzman, registered trademark, here in the historic city of Loftoff. Oh, hang on, forgot to turn this place on for the day. Here in the historic city of London, and in the city that critics recently described as being like the small Danish city of Aarhus, but bigger and different, New York, is the man who walks on four legs in the morning, two legs at noon, and three legs in the evening. Yes, it's Indecisive Limb Utilizers magazine's Man of the Year 2010, and a man wanted for questioning by the security staff at both the prosthetics department of Macy's and the Manhattan Snooker and Billiards Club after the recent spate of suddenly very slopey tables. It's John Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. We are back after our impromptu break, and thank you to all the Buglers as well who came up to me in the street this week asking if everything was okay. It's nice to have an impromptu support network available, coming out from under the cracks when called upon.
And thanks also to the followers of the Bugle Twitter feed for similar messages of concern. It didn't start as concern before I posted that. the reason for why we hadn't... It was messages of, where's our fucking Bugle? So sorry about that. But we are back. We are back this week. So, it was an unexpected family bereavement. In my family, I should add. Otherwise, that would have been a poor excuse. But we are back with Bugle 126. John, we've now done as many Bugles as excuses successfully made up by Abraham Lincoln to avoid going to the theatre before finally running out in 1865.
Listen to your heart. Theatre wasn't for you, Abe.
Amongst his best get-outs were, I can't go to the theatre, I'm scared of spiders. Well, I know there are no spiders in King Lear, but one King Lear plus three daughters equals eight legs. I can't risk it. And not tonight, Mary Todd. I've got to wait in at the White House in case a world war breaks out in Europe and I have to commit America one way or the other. Well, no, it's not strictly imminent, but it is just a matter of time. And also, no can do, pet. My hat's too big to fit through the door and I don't want to end up like Uncle Mike. Yes, that Uncle Mike. Uncle Mike, the human central supporting pillar. Crumbs, that reminds me, I forgot to feed him today. Better get some chow down to the Capitol building or that big boy is coming down. And his final 127th excuse proved to be his best. Not tonight, love. I still haven't fully got over what happened last time. And the week beginning Monday the 13th of September 2010, which means that if you travel back in time exactly 109 years and one extra week and swapped identities with the US President William McKinley, you are about to have a nightmare day, John. Not only were you about to have to sit through your wife, Ida, crapping on endlessly about the latest slippers she'd crocheted. What a hobby that was for a first lady. Go on, surprise me, Ida. Have you crocheted a cock and balls and another pair of moccasins? No? Well, do let me know when you do, darling. Not only that, John, but if you were McKinley, you were about to be assassinated. Bad day. Bad, bad,
bad day.
Bad day. Bad day.
Top story this week, Vanity Publishing. And former Prime Minister of Great Britain, Tony Blair's memoir, has hit the bookshops of this planet. And potentially of other planets as well. But at the moment, this planet is the only one that we know of. It's called A Journey, My Political Life. And its launch was an eagerly anticipated publishing sensation. Who can forget, Andy, last week, the scenes of children lining up outside bookstores at midnight, all dressed up as their favourite characters from the autobiography. Ex-Foreign Secretary Robin Cook was a popular costume. One little girl dressed like a very convincing Claire Short and was shouting something about the Iraq war being illegal. And one child was lying motionless on the ground, presumably having come as David Kelly. Either way, it was a festive atmosphere, Andy, and the kids looked like they couldn't wait to get the books home, start reading, and have their spirits and imaginations completely crushed.
There you go, David Kelly reference. Three assassination references. Or was it?
Yeah. Two and a half.
Yeah, he's had to cancel some book signings because of protests, John. He had eggs thrown at him in Dublin.
I'm so sorry for him, Andy. He's been through so much.
Well, it just shows that he's learning, John, because he is at last learning to back down in the face of public protests, just 7.5 years late.
He's donating the profits from his book to a charity organisation for British soldiers injured during the Iraq War, which is both an excellent idea and also technically and literally the least he could do. A political memoirs are notoriously self-serving at best. Often their authors are seen late night on bookshop security cameras breaking into stores and moving their books from the autobiography section to the history section, while their detractors hide in the pregnancy section and wait to move the books to the fiction shelves instead. It's a to and fro. In fact, in the interest of transparency, every political memoir, Andy, ever written should really be forced to have the same title, which should be, "No, you're all wrong. This is how it happened." By whoever.
And in the grand scheme of Blair's overall record on war, that was very much a hamster of mitigation on the end of an ethical seesaw that has a rhinoceros of repugnance squatting and defecating on the other end. Though, was this money, as some critics have claimed, blood money? Or was it merely further justification for Blair's decision to join America in invading Iraq? Because without the controversy created, there is no way he would have been paid so much as an advance or sold so many copies and thus be able to give so much money to the British Legion. So really, it's all starting to self-justify itself.
That's why prime ministers should never have their publishers as a key advisor during their time in office. Listen, you got to give me a little zazz to play with.
So Neville Chamberlain went wrong.
The two main characters in the story are Blair himself and ex-Chancellor and ex-Prime Minister and current holder of Pensioner Zinger 2010, Gordon Brown. The book is surprisingly honest about Blair's complicated relationship with him. It's not that the nature of the relationship is surprising, just that he's chosen to be so honest about it. Blair, after all, as you mentioned, has a proven record of not being a huge fan of the concept of honesty, and it is surprising that he suddenly decided to try it now. Well, how controversial were his statements about Brown? Not especially. To be honest, he describes Brown as maddening, which I don't think anyone in Britain would disagree with. In fact, it seems to be one of the least negative of his almost impressive number of character flaws. He also said that Brown lacked emotional intelligence. Again, I think Brown would struggle to make a decent legal case against that, partly because he lacked the social skills to be able to communicate a coherent defence to his lawyers effectively.
But he said in an interview this week, John, he said that he was still friends with Gordon Brown. And out of all the porkies that Blair may or may not have told over the last 13 years, that has to be right up there with the Weapons of Mass Destruction classic and the claim on page 324 of his memoirs that he is, in fact, Elvis. And if I may quote, did we get the serialisation for rights for this in the end? I can't remember. I think so. I think this is a Bugle World exclusive. Anyway, this is from page 324. "I realised that, whilst I'd done much great work unifying all humanity as Elvis, there was still much left to do, and the best way to do that was to fake my own death and reinvent myself as a creepily oversincere free market quasi-socialist with an unshakable belief in his own destiny." So there you go.
Beautifully put.
Have you read any of these memoirs, John?
Or any of Blair's memoirs?
Yeah.
What, have I read this book?
Yeah.
It's a quicker way to ask that, is it? No, yeah, I've read some extracts from it. I haven't read it all yet, no.
Because I haven't. I wanted to, but it's just we've got some quite nice stained glass swans in our living room window. And
yes.
I didn't want to read Blair's book and then I have no choice but to headbutt the stained glass swans to smithereens in frustration. So.
Safety first.
But I think it can be, without having read it, I think it can basically be summed up as, "I'm great, I'm really great, you've all forgotten how great I really am. Yeah, I made the odd tiny mistake, but only to highlight how great I am otherwise. The rest of British history will be a slow slide into nothingness in the shadow of my own magnificence." Oh no, hang on, no, that was from my own press release for my Edinburgh show. So I'm getting them mixed up.
Blair also said that he thought people had overestimated Brown's ability to be leader of the country. Oh, snap, Andy! Competent snap! Ouch! They're setting up to have a high-profile beef here, like 50 Cent and Puff Daddy. Maybe now they're going to each release books back and forth, slamming the other one. I just hope this doesn't spill into street violence, Andy. I don't want to see them form gangs like the Jets and the Sharks in West Side Story and have terrifying dance-offs, waving knives around in a fluid, choreographed movements up and down fire escapes.
Well, you didn't see the CCTV footage from the 1996 Labour conference, clearly. But he's a controversial figure, Blair. Clearly, he splits opinion like a banana. And his record on long-term planning for Iraq and Afghanistan has really put the f***ing abysmal into unbelievably f***ing abysmal. But it is interesting now that we're looking back on Blair with this, a bit of distance now. It's, 3 years since he was snatched away from us all at a tragically young age of 2.5 electoral terms. And He was a Prime Minister of paradox, John. He surfed off the Prime Ministerial coil on a tidal ripple of public indifference, and yet, at the same time, he was applauded by the Conservatives. His political enemy, supposedly, clapped him on his way out of the House of Commons as if a retiring Winston Churchill had just headbutted a porcelain Hitler whilst balancing a seal on a beach ball. He was a lover of peace, self-proclaimed big fan of peace, and signed Britain up for wars like a vulnerable pensioner for pyramid schemes. I mean, they all seemed such good deals at the time. He was a very odd man, very odd man. But above all, undisputed, three-time United Kingdom general election champion, John.
No one's denying that.
He never lost a general election. He lost other things, respect, credibility, face, marbles and Scotland, but never an election. And as a politician in this day and age, that is all anyone can ask of the kid. He, in fact, won more general elections than Gandhi, Mandela, Geldof and Jesus put together. And you cannot fight a statistic like that. Or if you do, that statistic will pin you down and rip your soul out.
Thank goodness he failed in his attempt to pass legislation saying if you win the Prime Ministership three times, you get to keep it.
I think he thinks he did pass it.
Yeah, he's certainly acting like it. The reaction to the book has been mixed at best. Labour leadership hopeful Diane Abbott accused Blair of putting the knife into Gordon Brown. And you know, if it wasn't a knife exactly, it was certainly some kind of pointy metal object, a screwdriver perhaps, or the sharpened end of a curtain rail. Mr. Blair described Gordon as a strange guy who, while he had enormous ability, had no instinct at the human gut level. He went on to say, political calculation? Yes. Political feelings? No. Analytical intelligence? Absolutely. Emotional intelligence? Zero. Guess what I would say to this is, will this kind of passage increase book sales? Yes. Are they a case study in loyalty? No. Is this a politically cynical move from Blair? Yes. Is that particularly surprising? No. Another interesting relationship with the book is between Blair and alcohol. In the book, he said he'd always been in control of his alcohol intake, but admitted that he'd been on the outer limits of units of alcohol per week, something that helped him to relax and escape the pressure. He writes, stiff whiskey or G&T before dinner, couple of glasses of wine, or even half a bottle with it. So not excessively excessive. I had a limit, but I was aware that it had become a prop. You know, it's a high-pressure job, and you can't blame him for wanting to wind down, but that is quite a lot of alcohol to have in your daily routine. It's nothing new. Of course, the British people view alcohol as very much their favourite form of self-annihilation. And Blair was always a populist Prime Minister. Perhaps he felt there was no better way for him to accurately reflect the British public than to get blackout drunk on a Friday night, urinate up the wall of 10 Downing Street, throw up on the doorstep before trying to pick a fight with a policeman. Truly, Andy, he was the people's Prime Minister.
He was drinking to forget. Unfortunately, he was drinking to forget the future.
He's, of course, far from the first UK Prime Minister who's ended each day, passed out, face down on the bed, still wearing his suit.
You're not going to do your Lord Aberdeen stuff again, are you?
Blair writes, the relationship between alcohol and Prime Ministers is a subject for a book all on its own. Please don't write it. I believed I was in control of the alcohol. However, you have to be honest, it's a drug. There's no getting away from it. When you think about it, it is true, Andy. Are all British politicians permanently sozzled? I know that Churchill was essentially hammered during most of the Second World War. In fact, who knows if he'd have been quite so militarily bold during the Battle of Britain without being shit-faced and standing outside the Houses of Parliament with a bottle of empty wine in his hand, staggering around and screaming at Messerschmitts. Come on, then! You and me! Outside now! I'll f*** you up, big man! I'm feisty! Come on, do it! I never punch an aeroplane first! Grow a pair, you metal f***s! And perhaps, in true British style, the reactions to his alcohol intake was not one of concern, Andy, not concern at all, but rather one of scoffing at the piddling amount involved. Former Home Secretary Lord Reed says, he wonders whether drinking one stiff gin and tonic and a couple of glasses of wine a night during dinner, was that a big step up? Well, it might have been for Tony, who didn't normally drink, but where I come from, a gin and tonic, two glasses of wine, you wouldn't give that to a budgie. That's what you take away, that he was drinking like a little girl. that he wasn't drinking enough. Is that really the moral to this story, Andy? He'd have been a better Prime Minister if he'd passed out earlier in the evening. Maybe there's something in that. Because, of course, an interesting side note to all this is that George W. Bush was a recovering alcoholic while in office, and I presume now. And it's perhaps a shame that Blair couldn't have convinced him to fall off the wagon. Bush's decision-making process might have benefited from being done through the fog of a gigantic hangover. Mr. President, are you ready to give the orders across the Iraq border? Oh, God, I just can't be bothered. I'm sorry, no loud noises at the moment. Let's all just be quiet for a bit. Mr. President, do you still want to push through the constitutional amendment to make marriage between a man and a woman? Oh, I don't know. Is it quicker not to do it? Let them do what they want. Just tell them to keep the noise down. I'm just going to take a quick nap on my desk. Of the smaller details in the book, Blair claimed that after the death of Princess Diana, who I still don't believe is actually gone, Andy, I think she faked her death and is working on a turkey farm in Nebraska with Elvis. But that's besides the point.
I heard she was in the relief rotation at the at the Wichita Wife Swappers.
All of this is beside the point. It's that Blair claims he prepared his now famous People's Princess speech on the back of an envelope with the help of Alistair Campbell. And there is just no way that's true, Andy. Why is it people always claim they've written things on envelopes? If it isn't envelopes, it's napkins. There's no way that Blair wrote that on an envelope, mainly because he lived in 10 f***ing Downing Street, where I'm sure there was ample supplies of notepaper available to him. It's one of those maddening moments of forced folksiness that he loves so much. Oh, I'm just like you. I'll write on whatever's lying around too. No, you're not like us. You're the f***ing Prime Minister, and that's fine. There's no need to be like us. Use the ample watermarked stationery provided. We paid for it. It'd be a waste not to use it.
Well, I think, actually, maybe this might explain the lack of planning that went into Iraq, John, that the envelope just ran out of space. He just wrote, win war, dot, 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 and that was all there was room for. You do get the feeling that if Bush and Blair had been in charge of the Apollo 11 expedition to the moon, it would have ended up with Buzz Aldrin saying into his special walkie-talkie, what the f***, Houston? Can you run that past me again? We've got to make our own way home. Literally and metaphorically inflammatory action news now, and, well, it's off, John. That sounds like the Quran burning is off. Now, I guess this is good news. Pastor Jones, the man who puts the ass into pasta, has postponed his threatened bonfire of the Qurans. And I think I speak for the entire planet when I say, thank f*** for that.
Yep, I think you do, Andy. I think that's basically the feeling everywhere. There are things in this world, Andy, that have been designed to benefit from being put into flames, yep. Chief amongst them being coal, marshmallows, and Darth Vader's corpse.
And Catholics.
Well, I'm not going to disagree with that. There are other items that it's best to give a wide berth when it comes to fire, such as American flags, 1970s sofas, and crucially, the Quran. Crucially. Sadly, this indisputable fact was lost on Terry Jones, Pastor Terry Jones, who in his intensely finite wisdom had announced that he planned to hold a ceremonial burning of Qurans on September the 11th. And, you know, this did indeed prompt a worldwide reaction of, what? Seriously? And oh, for f***ing sake, what's this guy's f***ing problem?
As publicity stunts go, John, I'm not using rhyming slang when I say that. you have to hand it to the pastor. He had a congregation of 50 people at his
Just
church.
Just 50, yeah.
Who thought he was probably a bit weird, but basically okay. Now he has a congregation of 7 billion people, 6.99 billion of whom think he's a total prick. But that other 0.01 billion could prove to be a very lucrative market if he plays it right. And that's the problem with the world, John. There are too many people in it, and the percentages just don't work out.
Yeah, among the group of basically everyone who was against this was General David Petraeus, who pointed out that such a moronic action could put US troops in Afghanistan in even more danger than they're already in. And even President Obama, who, while acknowledging that the pastor technically had a right to do this, said that plans are a recruitment bonanza for Al-Qaeda. Presumably that now replaces their usual popular autumn recruitment bonanza, which is like a village fete fundraiser held in the mountains of Afghanistan. There's usually a raffle where you can win ammunition and small machine guns, or a refreshing day at a jihad health spa. There's also the Dunk the Infidel stall, which is very popular, and a Pin the Mushroom Cloud on Israel game.
And free T-shirts. I mean, that is the ultimate recruiting sergeant for me. Free T-shirt can win you to any cause.
All you need, T-shirt cannon. No man can resist a T-shirt cannon, Andy.
Amen. So it's a bit clearly a massive relief that it's not going to happen at the moment. He says he's postponed it rather than fully cancelled it. But be interesting to see
what a tease. What a tease, Andy.
I don't know. It's very hard to say, hypothetically, how fundamentalist Islam would have responded. I mean, you'd hope they wouldn't have gone over the top. Maybe just responded with some trash talking. Taking the mickey out of his job title. You know, say, this pasta's going to be cooked. Spaghetti out of here. I tell him not to burn those books. I don't want to be picky, he'll be punished for silly stunts like this. We'll pen a very strong letter to our local newspaper and come and knock on his door. And if he's not in, we'll speak to that Swedish girl who lives next door to him. You know, that lass, Anya. Or the guy who sets up lighting at music gigs in the area and changed his name out of respect for the former British Prime Minister. That's him, Rigatoni. After we finish with him, we'll have crushed him to a tiny pulp. So he'd better book a teeny weeny coffin for what's left of him. I don't care if he's got a pet who might be upset by it. A dog, for example. Or a kitty. A kitty. The world is outraged by this, from the Pope to the capital city of India. Il Papa, Delhi. What'll it cost to make him call this off? I'm a bit strapped for cash at the moment, so I can loan him $50 until the weekend. But he can forget...
Andy, what you're doing at the moment is more provocative than burning Qurans to me.
He can forget any hope of getting anything unless he pulls his fire out. Come on, let's make up. Give us a couscous. I'm done.
Unforgivable.
I'm done.
One of the...
I just think it would be nice if one day... Al-Qaeda and their ilk responded with a string of puns. And that is my contribution to the passage of world peace, John.
Okay, well, contribution accepted, Andy. One of the least objectionable of Terry Jones's many chasmous character flaws is that he both has the name of a great member of Monty Python and also has the physical appearance of a Monty Python character. He has a huge handlebar moustache, and you keep expecting a squeaky voice to come out of his misguided face saying... I'm a very naughty boy. Ooh, what a bloody nuisance I am. And someone slightly more surprising who's also angry at what's going on in Gainesville at the moment is Shirley Phelps Roper, who's a leader of the Westboro Baptist Church and is also the daughter of the homophobic knuckle Fred Phelps. I believe this technical term for him is a for the ages, who does things like holding protests outside the funerals of US soldiers, saying their death was a punishment from God for America's tolerance towards gays, and who has also called the Prophet Muhammad a pedophilic gigolo. Now, her objection is that in 2008, she and her father's group set fire to a Quran in plain view on a Washington, D.C. street, and no one's given them any credit for it, saying, we did it a long time before this guy. Oh, good. That's it. That's the best objection you can possibly have. Been done. We've been ripped off.
So now is the official Bugle guide to the list of occasions in history when burning religious texts has helped resolve a situation. Moving on. There were various compromises suggested to Pastor Jones, including that he just poured a pint of brandy over the pile of Qurans like a Christmas pudding, so it could look like it's burning but not actually be significantly damaged. They suggested he burn something else instead, like a pile of chicken burgers shaped like the Quran, which could then be barbecued and fed to local Muslim children in a gesture of reconciliation. Or that he could burn himself on top of the pile of Qurans, then both sides would have got what they wanted. Or he could have renamed his International Burner Quran Day to International Burner Quran Day and medievally burned the fashion designer and renowned witch Donna Quran at the stake for refusing to confess to her crimes. Alternatively, one option suggested to him was that he calm the f*** down and have a plate of sandwiches and a glass of lemonade. But all these were rejected, John. And this is the problem with First Amendment rights, John. They provide a loophole for f*** pigs to behave like c***s.
Yes, that's correct.
Sorry, viewers.
He does indeed.
Quite a sweary bugle so far.
It has, yeah.
That's what happens when you have a week off. You get 2 weeks swearing in 1 week.
That's the problem.
Ped is sitting there I was standing in for Chris this week on the production desks with now three pages of things he has to bleep out.
That's right. Get that bleep finger all warmed up. It's it's strange. He's called this his International Burn the Quran Day, and it happens to coincide with the first annual International Arsehole Day. Don't know how that worked out. It's clearly a lie. There's nothing international about this. It's like the International House of Pancakes. It is just a house of pancakes with the word international tagged onto it. I don't know how much he even believes or means any of this. He said that he would stop if Obama personally called him and told him not to do it. He just wants a phone call from the president. Is that what all of this is about? He also said that as an American Christian, he has the right to burn Islam's holy book because it is, and I quote, full of lies. Well, I do hope he's burning the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe as well then, Andy, because that wasn't heavy on facts either.
Well, I think maybe this is the solution. Just burn all books in the world and then everyone is equally offended.
Yeah, that could be it.
But, of course, it's going to be quite a simplistic gesture from the pastor because it is hard to make a nuanced point with a bonfire. That's why, amongst others, Shakespeare, T.S. Eliot, Norman Mailer and Shakira have always tended to use the written words rather than the physical conflagration to make their points. In Shakira's case, often in conjunction with the exposed midriff and the catchy pop ditty. Which, to be fair, Shakespeare did exactly the same. There were just no video cameras around at the time. And he was ripped as well. Much better six-pack than Chris Marlowe and Ben Johnson put together, I'd say. And in fact, Shakira's breakthrough hit, Whenever, Wherever, is in fact Hamlet's smash hit soliloquy chart-topping number one, To Be or Not To Be, mm-hmm. put through an automated online translation program from English to Colombian and back again 10 times, whilst her record-breaking mega-seller Hips Don't Lie, which incidentally is a baseless claim, just try getting the truth out of Slobodan Milosevic's hips, but that song is basically a 3-minute, 38-second version of Titus Andronicus.
It's true, Andy. I believe the first folio of Hamlet's To Be or Not To Be speech featured the couplets, lucky that my breasts are small and humble, otherwise they'd be confused with mountains.
And that's why Ophelia was so hot.
Middle East peace news now. Let's talk about peace, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things, all the bad things that have been perpetrated by both sides. Let's talk about peace.
You're expanding your repertoire, John. I mean, you've moved because in the early days you're very much focused on the cock rock ballads.
Yeah, well, now I'm happy to move into, Colour Me Bad's early 90s R&B territory. Right. I'm willing to stretch my legs.
Was that not Salt and Pepper, that song?
No, Andy, that was Colour Me Bad.
Ped, you look like the kind of man who knows who sang songs like that.
Come on, Ped, back me off. That was Colour Me Bad.
All right.
Oh, was it?
He sang Salt and Pepper.
Oh, God, you're right, Andy. I was thinking about, I want to sex you up. You're right, it was Salt and Pepper.
There you go, you owe me 50,000 lira.
Andy, the first serious peace talks for over a year and a half between Israel and the country they refuse to acknowledge as Palestine took place last week. I mean, there have been other peace talks, but they've not been officially serious ones. They are the little-discussed joke peace talks that happen semi-regularly in the region. Basically, occasionally the two sides meet secretly in a heavily secured conference room, say, we should bring peace to this region immediately, then all pause for a moment before bursting into tears of laughter, slapping each other on the back and saying, classic! See you guys at the next one. Burn in hell! Usually they play tricks on each other too. Chairs have been rigged with whoopee cushions in the conference room. And they also try to catch each other out with Zionist pig says what? Or terrorist sympathisers says pardon? And almost every drink on the table has been spiked with industrial strength laxatives. These serious talks, however, hopefully are going to promise a much more sober affair. So, how do you achieve a lasting peace between the two sides? Is it even possible? I guess that question is slightly undercut by how often and how desperately those questions have been asked over the last 4 decades. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton tried to put a positive spin on the talks, partly because she has to professionally, and partly because she has to personally as well, to stop just giving up on the first day and spending 3 hours carving a picture of a 62 Chevrolet into the conference table with a penknife while Netanyahu and Abbas shouted at each other. Hillary Clinton stated that both sides had the opportunity to end this conflict. I don't think either side would deny they have the opportunity. It's just whether they decide to seize that opportunity with both hands or shove that opportunity into a sack, weigh it down with bricks and head for the nearest river. It's a tricky job for US Secretary of State, selling these talks to the participants and the world at large. It's like selling lottery tickets to people. You want people to focus on the undeniably fantastic prize without thinking too closely about the odds of them actually winning it. So it's now up to President Obama over the next couple of years to coax, prod and press the two sides like a zookeeper trying to convince two pandas who hate each other to mate. Look, it's for the greater good, Ling Ling. If you two don't do it now, the entire future of your species is at risk. I don't understand. You're both like bamboo. You're both covered in fur. How big can your differences possibly be? One thing's for sure, on the eve of any meetings like this, Andy, you can trust extremists to do something that's the opposite of helpful. And sure enough, right on cue, just before the talks began, Hamas launched an attack that killed four Israeli settlers on the West Bank. It's like trying to bake a lasagna, Andy, and then just before you pop it in the oven, sprinkling broken glass all over it, then whipping out your John C. Reilly and wazzing over the whole thing, popping it back in the oven and starting to lay the table.
You're what, John? You're John C. Reilly.
You're John C. Reilly, yeah. I just thought
it'd be a good name. Is that a personal beef, is it?
No. I just thought it'd be
one of your movie friends.
Good name. No, I like him very much, Andy. I just thought he'd be good. He'd be a good name for a penis.
I'll pass that on to him next time he's
in
London.
Character penis, yeah? You know. A versatile character penis. The White House released a statement saying that the brutal attack by Hamas underscores how far the enemies of peace will go to try and block progress. But to be fair to those enemies, Andy, that's already been underscored numerous times. They've underscored it so many times they've essentially ripped a hole in the paper. The two-day series of so-called intensive encounters, which sounds like the offerings of an escort service in the back of a tabloid newspaper, were to offer a working dinner on Wednesday, hosted by the president in the White House's old family dining room, whose, and I quote, soft yellow walls and curtains provide a more intimate setting than the state dining room. Is this how low we've sunk now, Andy, using feng shui to get the talks going? Is that the bold new strategy for bilateral talks? Interior design. Why not pipe whale noises in there and pump in the smell of fresh baked bread? If this truly is our once-in-a-generation opportunity, for sake, let's throw in one of those Zen water features in the corner of the room and have Carol King hanging by a harness from the chandelier, softly strumming You've Got a Friend. Why are we holding back with soft yellow walls, Andy? Do we want peace or not?
Is Carol King another euphemism for the penis or not?
No. Right. No, Andy. Absolutely not.
Your emails now, and this one comes from John Parsons in Auckland, New Zealand. In the southern hemisphere. Yep. Piss-poor hemisphere, that, in my book.
Oh, steady on, Andy. That's pretty general. That's a lot of landmass to dismiss.
Yeah, it's just not as good as the north.
Well, again, Andy, I think that's a little rough.
Yes, you know, see, I'm not saying it's all bad. I'm just saying, you know, as hemispheres go, there are better hemispheres. Anyway, he writes on the 76, ow, that fucking hurt. Dear John, Andy and Chris, I've been a passionate listener to your fine and upstanding podcast down here in the furthest reaches of the old colonies. Mm-hmm. However, under medical advice, I have now ceased to listen.
What?
The reason being that I was listening on the bus to Bugle 125 the other day, when I laughed at the unfathomable bullshit pouring forth. Unfortunately, the psycho sitting opposite me took offence and thought I was laughing at his freaky haircut before subsequently shouting in my face in a Dirty Harry-esque manner and concluding by punching me in the face and breaking my nose.
No!
So, goodbye the Bugle.
That's terrible.
I will now in future have to listen to BBC World Service podcasts about the world's greatest bridges. Less bullshit, but less chance of being beaten to a pulp.
Well, is it, though?
Don't give in, John!
And also, is it? Because if you're listening to the BBC World Service, you're kind of just nodding, saying, interesting. Maybe then a lunatic will think you're making some kind of positive comment about their hair. Either way, the problem is with the lunatic, not with you. I refuse to take any responsibility for this horrible act.
I think it's incumbent on all of us buglers to stand up to the bullies, John, and we all have a duty, whether or not we are actually listening to the bugle, but on behalf of John Parsons from Auckland, New Zealand, to laugh in the face of any threatening-looking person on public transport.
That's true.
To show our solidarity with our afflicted friend.
With our fallen brother.
Yeah. Stay strong, John. Stay strong, John, in New Zealand. Most people in New Zealand have their noses broken on a daily basis anyway, just by playing rugby, I think. It's just one great big rugby match life in New Zealand.
We have an email here from Mazar Majid, who says, "Dear John and Andy, I write to inform you that lots of money can be made from the Bugle. In India, millions of rupees are bet every week. The Bugle goes out, and I'm telling you, big money can be made. I have contact with Indian bookies, and they're prepared to pay us handsomely. All you need to do is say the word 'no ball' in the 3rd, 10th and 18th minute of the Bugle. I promise cash payments of at least £5,000. If John is in America, I can transfer the money to him by PayPal. Please be discreet. Last time I tried doing this, Mohammed Amir decided to give it away by bowling the biggest no ball ever. Yours sincerely, Mazar Majid." Well, how about that, Andy?
Well, it's pretty tempting. I mean, there have been times, I will admit now, in the past, where I have deliberately done an unfunny bit of material on the Bugle just to...
I have wondered about that, Andy.
It's pretty rare. Pretty damn rare,
I think. Your puns tend to come at a very precise time of the Bugle every time. And when trying to think of the reasoning, why would Andy be doing all these puns? He can't physically or emotionally be enjoying this experience. He certainly isn't for entertainment's sake. Or maybe he's making money on the side from illegal Indian betting syndicates. At least that is some way of explaining it. Sport now, and Andy, I know you're a huge fan of golfer Jim Furyk. You must have been dismayed when a couple of weeks ago you heard that he overslept and missed his tee time at the Pro-Am at Ridgewood Country Club. And of course, under PGA rules, he was disqualified. And it's just an absolute disaster for Furyk, Andy. He's not the only athlete who has got in trouble for being late. In 1982, the Braves pitcher, Pascual Perez, got lost on the road, was trying to find the stadium. Apparently, he circled the city three times and eventually ran out of gas. So, you know, there's something. Of course, just this season, Ken Griffey Jr., one of the greatest baseball players of all time, fell asleep in the Seattle Mariners clubhouse and missed a chance to pinch hit in a game against the Angels. A teammate said he'd gone back in about the fifth inning to get a jacket and he didn't come back. I went in the seventh inning and he was in his chair sound asleep. A few weeks later, Griffey retired. And my favourite, in 1896, the United States Olympic team thought they'd arrived in Athens 12 days before the games, but the Greeks were using the Julian, not the Gregorian calendar, which differed by 12 days. And in fact, they only just got there in the nick of time.
That's an excellent story. I hadn't heard that before.
Isn't it? It's an excellent story.
So, and this links into the first of our Ryder Cup profiles. Jim Furyk. Jim Furyk was born at Roswell in 1934 as part of an experiment by the US government to create a golfer who could take on aliens at golf and be confident of winning. Furyk's existence was kept secret for decades as the scientists worked on ironing out the various kinks in his swing caused by him eating a tub full of magnesium when he was a baby. The magnesium made him immortal, but left a funny twitch in his swing that remains even to this day. Furyk was first unleashed on a golf tournament in 1966 when he won the Pebble Beach Under 10 Girls competition. Uh-huh. He won by two shots from Petunia Drayard, was later disqualified, not for being a 32-year-old man, but for slightly grounding his club in a bunker. Furyk was so incensed that he immediately retired from junior girls golf and focused instead on becoming a PGA Tour pro. Although immortal, Jim Furyk, like the mythological Greek character he's always dreamed of being, is not ageless, and every year, usually after the Augusta Masters, he spends a week sitting in a vat of rat plasma to preserve his youthful looks.
Oh, well, Andy, I'm never, ever going to be able to look at Jim Furyk again without thinking of him sitting motionless in a bath of rat plasma. That has just enlivened the Ryder Cup for me no end.
Wait till you hear what Zach Johnson gets up to. and the less said about Stuart Sink, the better. Well, that's all we got time for this week, Buglers.
That's it.
Yep. So,
done, Andy.
So,
tag it and bag it.
Yep. Inappropriate, John. So we'll be back next week.
Yep.
See you then, Buglers.
Have a lovely week, Buglers. Goodbye.